Okay, good afternoon, everybody. This is Bio241, and it's Wednesday, December 3rd. So we got today's lecture and then Monday's lecture, and then that's it for the class. And some of you might be done with lab already. I'm not sure. Yeah, you're done. So that's it. So you don't have to go to lab during finals week, but your lab instructor should be available to you to look over tests or check grades or whatever. So even though they don't have a lab scheduled, they have to make themselves available to you. Okay? So send them an email or whatever. All right, don't forget, your final is not this Monday, but it's a week from this Monday, right? On the 15th, from 1 to 3 in this room. That will be fine. Okay? And it's not comprehensive. So maybe I'll change the class around one of these days and make some comprehensive part to the exams. And okay, well, we're talking about the cardiovascular system, blood pressure and flow and resistance and all that kind of stuff. So let's write some equations down on the board that talk about these things. Okay, so let's start with cardiac output. Cardiac output is flow, okay, which is a volume per time, a volume of something per time, for instance, like milliliters per minute. Right, that's flow as opposed to speed. What is speed? Speed is just it's just how fast something moves along, and that is a speed would be like a centimeters per minute. Or so it's just a length per time. That's speed or velocity, which is a different kind of concept than flow. Flow is an actual volume of fluid that's moving, okay, per minute past a certain point. But speed is how fast something is going. So we talked about that in terms of various kinds of blood vessels. What blood vessel has the slowest speed? What vessel has the slowest speed of blood flowing through it? And it's important because that particular blood vessel needs time for it to do whatever it's doing. And actually, maybe I could find that slide for you. It's probably not too far away. Oh, look at that. It was right there. What blood vessels have the slowest speed or slowest velocity? Okay. You know what? It's not on there. But here is a graph of the surface area per the different kinds of blood vessel types. And the surface area is going to be, or the cross-sectional area, is going to be inversely related to the speed of fluid. So which area right here has the highest cross-sectional area? If we were to add up all the cross-sectional areas of these vessels, which ones have the highest? The capillaries, and remember I said the velocity is inversely related, and so the place where the blood flows the slowest is in capillaries, and that's important because exchange takes place in capillaries. So if blood speeded through capillaries, there wouldn't be time for exchange to take place. But because blood slows down in capillaries, there's plenty of time for exchange to take place. All right, so flow, cardiac output. What is cardiac output equal to? That you got to know. Cardiac output, maybe I could ask you how to calculate that on the test. What is it equal to? Cardiac output. Stroke volume, which is the amount of blood that the heart pumps every time it beats, every time it contracts. That's the amount of blood that is pumped out of the heart. Right? So that's not quite cardiac output, but it's on the way there. We need something else. The heart rate. Stroke volume times heart rate is equal to cardiac output. And cardiac output, don't forget, is a flow. Flow equals cardiac output is stroke volume times your heart rate, which is what, milliliters per minute, because the beats cancel out in this kind of thing. Okay, another important equation has to do with flow. What is flow of any vessel or any kind of fluid going to be equal to? What is flow equal to? What's the driving force for flow? Pressure, the delta of pressure. All right, so I'm going to put delta P right here. Okay, but there's something that belongs in the denominator, something that's going to slow flow down. Okay, the resistance. right? So you got to remember, this is a nice basic equation, right? So flow is equal to the pressure. If pressure is zero, something won't flow through that particular tube. You got to have a pressure gradient for things to flow, and something will slow that flow down, and that's what we call resistance. And then you should know, according to Poiseuille's equation, what things factor into resistance, like the length of the blood vessel, right? As the blood vessel gets longer, the resistance increases. The viscosity of the fluid flowing through changes the resistance. And what's the most important term that determines resistance? Because it's not in Poiseuille's equation all by itself, it's in there four times over. What is that one term? And that is the radius of that tube. So as the radius increases, right, the resistance decreases tremendously fast because it's radius times radius times radius times radius. It's radius to the fourth power. So that's one way that your body can regulate flow through tissues by vasoconstriction or vasodilation. Okay, so what we're interested in looking at right now is blood pressure. Okay, so where do we find blood pressure in this nice simple equation? That's this term right here, okay? Delta P is just your blood pressure. It's going to flow from high pressure to low. Low is by your right atrium. High pressure is by your left ventricle. All right, so let's rearrange this equation right here. And as a matter of fact, instead of saying delta P, let's just say blood pressure. But we're going to know that that at your right atrium, that's going to be zero. All right, so blood pressure is equal to... Or flow is equal to blood pressure divided by resistance. But let's rearrange this so that we can look at blood pressure right here. How are we going to rearrange this equation so we can get blood pressure all by itself on one side? What we do is multiply what? The top and bottom over here by, that's one, okay, by this equation. And when we do that, okay, we get, right, flow, oops, we get flow times resistance is equal to blood pressure. But I don't want to leave it like that. I want to flip it around. I want to say blood pressure is equal to flow times resistance. Okay, so that's these two things are exactly the same. Okay, because what we're going to consider is blood pressure right now. Now, what did we say flow was? Cardiac output. Okay, so flow is equal to cardiac output. So let's go over here. Blood pressure is equal to cardiac output times resistance. All right, so this should be fairly intuitive to you to appreciate that flow is going to be determined by the pressure divided by whatever resistance there is to flow. Right, and then by simply rearranging it, we get this equation right here, and this is not quite so intuitive. So if you want to maintain blood pressure, what are two ways that you can regulate blood pressure or maintain blood pressure? You can adjust cardiac output, okay, and if you want to adjust cardiac output, what are some parameters that you can change to either increase or decrease cardiac output? Okay. The stroke volume, that is how rigorous the heart contracts, how forcefully the heart contracts. And the second thing is, what, the heart rate, right? So blood pressure, okay, I'm going to leave that up there. Blood pressure is going to be controlled by stroke volume times heart rate, because stroke volume times heart rate is really cardiac output, which is this thing right here, times something we call resistance or total peripheral resistance, the resistance in all those blood vessels for blood flowing through it. Okay, so if you want to increase blood pressure, we could increase any one of these things because they are directly related to each other, right? Blood pressure is directly related to stroke volume. Blood pressure is directly related to heart rate. And because of this equation, you see that blood pressure is also directly related to the total peripheral resistance. So anytime resistance increases, so does blood pressure, okay, if everything else were to be held constant. Okay, So I think that's, I wanted to show you that little derivation. So when we look at some slides, you can see why these parameters behave that way. I think it's easy to see stroke volume and heart rates affect on blood pressure, but maybe not so much what we call peripheral resistance or total peripheral resistance. But always just start right with this nice basic equation, which is a really simple Poiseuille's equation. Okay, so blood pressure is controlled mainly by heart rate, stroke volume, and peripheral resistance. Do you believe that? Yeah, because that's the equation right there. All right, so if resistance increases, what happens to blood pressure? It increases. If your heart rate increases, what happens to blood pressure? It increases. And what about if the contractility of the heart increases? So when it contracts, the stroke volume goes up. What happens to blood pressure? It increases as well, because all these things are directly related. So an increase in any of these can result in increased blood pressure. So sympathoadrenal activity raises blood pressure via arteriolar vasoconstriction. So arterioles are going to vasoconstrict, right? When something vasoconstricts, what happens to this arterm? It's going to increase, right? Vasoconstriction, because of the fourth power rule, it's going to really increase the resistance. And as the resistance increases, what happens to blood pressure? Okay, if resistance increases, what happens to blood pressure? It increases as well, okay, due to vasoconstriction. If arterioles vasodilate, all right, and resistance goes down, what happens to blood pressure? It's going to go down as well, if everything else is held constant. Okay, so you might want to be able to derive that equation right there for yourself. All right, and kidneys play a role in blood pressure regulation by controlling blood volume. All right, and as your blood volume increases, all right, you have more blood returning to the heart. We call that increased venous return. And as blood is returning to the heart, right, filling the heart up, how does the heart react to that blood that's filling the heart up? So as blood returns to the heart, what happens to the size of the heart? It extends, right? It fills more up with blood. And what happens to the heart activity according to that intrinsic mechanism of the heart? When more blood comes back to the heart, if it's a healthy heart, how does the heart respond? Okay, and there's an important law that you should know that describes that. It's the intrinsic property of the heart. As the heart stretches more, does it get weaker? Or does it beat with more force? Or does it stay the same? Okay. Remember this curve right here? Like this. This is tension. And this is stretch of the heart. Usually we operate right in here. So as the heart stretches, what happens to the force that's developed by the heart? It increases. Right? So what law was that? That's called the Frank-Starling law of the heart. Okay? So when you have additional venous return, you move up the ascending limb of that Frank-Starling curve and the heart gets stronger. Right? So that's why sometimes when people have a hemorrhage and their heart starts to fail, we like to put volume in their blood and makes their heart beat more strongly, prevents them from going into shock. That's just an intrinsic mechanism of the heart. Okay, so that's the second statement that we see right here. Okay, kidneys play a role in blood pressure regulation, because blood volume affects stroke volume. Because venous return, as blood volume increases, venous return increases, and as the heart stretches, stroke volume increases. And if stroke volume increases, what happens to blood pressure? It increases, right? So as fluid volume increases, venous return increases, stroke volume increases because of the Frank-Starling law, and therefore blood pressure increases. So that's one way that we can regulate blood pressure or maintain blood pressure. Okay. Another important mechanism for maintaining blood pressure is the baroreceptor reflex. And it's activated by changes in blood pressure. There are receptors that can measure blood pressure. And these are in the walls of blood vessels, right? Namely the arch of the aorta and the carotid sinus. And this goes all the way back. You can look at your slides from the PowerPoint slides from the first lab that you did. Okay, I gave you all PowerPoint slides that talked about the baroreceptor reflex. So a baroreceptor is a receptor that can measure pressure inside your body. And the ones for the baroreceptor reflex in particular are in the carotid sinus. Who can point to their carotid sinus? From anatomy. Or from lab in this class. Where's the carotid sinus at? It's at the bifurcation, when the common carotid bifurcates into the internal and external carotid arteries, and it's right about here. There are pressure receptors right there, okay? And if you press on it, you might stimulate those baroreceptors and you might pass out. So don't press on it too hard, okay? That would be terrible if you were to do that. Okay, so, well, it says right here, the arch of the aorta and the carotid sinuses. Right, that's right at the bifurcation there. And as blood pressure increases, right, it stretches those blood vessels and it's going to send signals to the vasomotor center and the cardiac control center is in the medulla. Right, so you have just a typical kind of response loop right here where the stimulus is a change in blood pressure, the receptor is a baroreceptor, the afferent pathway, okay, I think is the hypoglossal nerve, which goes to the integration center. Where's the integration center at? That is the vasomotor center and cardiac control center. And in the vasomotor center, you have a number that says what your normal blood pressure should be. And if the baroreceptors are sending information that does not match up with the set point, right, then the medulla or the vasomotor center is going to make a decision on what to do to get your blood pressure back to where it should be. Right, and so then it's going to send efferent signals down the efferent pathway to some kind of effector organ to counteract what that initial stimulus was. So the stimulus is going to subtract from the response, and we call that a negative feedback loop. All right, so the baroreceptor reflex is the most sensitive reflex that measures sudden changes in blood pressure. All right, so the baroreceptor reflex is important for second-to-second regulation of your blood pressure. All right, not long-term, not day-to-day or week-to-week, but second-to-second. So right now, you're sitting down, and after class, you're going to stand up, and in that process of standing up, your blood pressure is going to drop pretty dramatically, probably more so than in some people than others. Some people might actually feel like they're going to black out when they stand up. All right, so your blood pressure drops. These baroreceptors monitor that drop in blood pressure. All right, and that signal is sent to the medulla. The medulla says your blood pressure is way too low, and we need to boost it back up. So the medulla is going to do what? How is the medulla going to control your blood pressure? What can it do? What can it do so that you don't pass out in a hurry? Okay, if your blood pressure is decreasing, the medulla is going to send sympathetic impulses to the heart to increase your heart rate. And as your heart rate momentarily speeds up, what happens to your blood pressure? It goes back up to normal, right? And your heart is going to beat more forcefully as well. Your stroke volume is going to go up. Both of these things will increase your blood pressure so that you don't pass out, okay, when you change body position. So that's how the baroreceptor reflex works, okay, and it can operate very, very quickly. All right, so, here you have it right here. So here is the carotid sinus. Here's the aortic arch. Here are baroreceptors. This is the afferent path. So here are the receptors, right, the baroreceptors. What would be the stimulus in the example that we just used? What's the stimulus? So you're going from sitting to standing. What's the stimulus going to be? Blood pressure. And what's going to happen to blood pressure when you stand up? It's going to drop, right? So there's going to be, the stimulus is a drop in blood pressure. The receptors are the baroreceptors sending signals to the medulla oblongata, the cardiac control center, and the vasomotor center. The vasomotor center is going to say, oh, blood pressure is decreasing. I compared the signals that you're sending me with the set point that I have right here. And what is my set point say? What is the set point? What number is in the medulla? Of course, the medulla doesn't know millimeters of mercury, but it just knows what it should be, but in terms of millimeters of mercury, what's normal blood pressure? 120 over 80, that's right. Okay, and so it's less than 120 over 80. So the medulla then makes up its mind to do something. Blood pressure is too low. What's it going to do? Figure out a way to boost your blood pressure up, and will it pick, so it's making a decision, will it pick the parasympathetic nervous system or sympathetic nervous system? Sympathetic nervous system. So it's going to send signals, action potentials, down the spinal cord, okay, and it's going to leave and go through the sympathetic chain ganglia, follow the cardiac nerve over to the right atrium. It's going to stimulate the SA node. It's going to cause the SA node to depolarize more quickly. So the heart rate is going to increase. What's the effect on blood pressure when heart rate increases? It increases because of that equation right there. It also sends signals to the ventricular myocardium right here so that it contracts with more force. And what's going to happen to blood pressure when that happens? It's going to increase. And when the heart contracts with more force, why does blood pressure increase? Because what changes? The stroke volume goes up, right? So blood pressure and stroke volume are directly related to each other. And when the heart rate and stroke volume increase, blood pressure increases. That's opposite to the stimulus, so that provides for a nice negative feedback response or feedback loop, right? Okay. Now, the other thing you see on this diagram, what happens if your blood pressure goes up too high? Maybe I'll say, you know what, we're not going to have the final Monday. We're just going to take it after class today, okay, and get it over with. So your blood pressure is going up, right, sending those signals to the medulla, all right? Okay, so now what is the medulla going to say? Ah, your blood pressure is too high. Does it make up its mind to send signals out the sympathetic nervous system or the parasympathetic nervous system? That parasympathetic nervous system, which you remember is craniosacral and the vagus nerve from the medulla, okay, goes to the sinoatrial node, and it inhibits the sinoatrial node. All right, so what happens to heart rate then? It decreases, and as heart rate decreases, what happens to blood pressure? It goes back to normal. So that's another nice negative feedback loop. Okay, so the parasympathetic nervous system usually does not go to the ventricle, doesn't cause the heart to contract less rigorously, but it does go to the rhythmic centers in the heart which control heart rate. But that's okay for regulating blood pressure because blood pressure is controlled by what? Stroke volume, heart rate, and resistance as well. Okay, and if your blood pressure were to decrease dramatically, right, not only would the medulla oblongata send sympathetic signals to the heart to increase stroke volume and heart rate, but guess what else it's going to do? It's going to send signals to blood vessels to cause vasoconstriction. Right? And when something vasoconstricts, what happens to resistance in that blood vessel? Yeah? Resistance increases when it vasoconstricts, so sympathetic activity increases blood pressure because it increases stroke volume, increases heart rate, and it also increases total peripheral resistance. Right, so all of those things work together to maintain heart rate. So that's the baroreceptor reflex, most important mechanism for short-term regulation of blood pressure, right? Because it's a neuronal reflex. All right, so what do we have here? Let's take a look at this. This is the baroreceptor reflex in a flow diagram, kind of chart. Okay, so going from a lying position to a standing position, when you stand up, venous return to the heart decreases. Blood is going to pool in various parts of your body. It's not going to flow back. All right, so if it doesn't flow back to the heart, all right, what happens to the size of the heart? It doesn't fill up so much with blood. And then what happens? Okay, the end-diastolic volume decreases. The result would be decreased stroke volume. How would you explain decreased stroke volume when end-diastolic volume decreases? What's the law? It's the law. The Frank Starling law, right? Okay, so the heart has to stretch to maintain force of contraction. So decreased venous return decreases end-diastolic volume, decreases stroke volume. Stroke volume decreases, so does cardiac output, or the flow from the heart. and that decreases blood pressure. So this is the stimulus right here, decreased blood pressure when you change body position. The receptors are baroreceptors that monitor that stimulus. Then here are the afferent pathways to the medulla. So this is the integration center that contains the set point. The integration center makes up a decision on what to do. The initial stimulus was a decrease in blood pressure. So how would you bring blood pressure back up? Parasympathetic stimulation or sympathetic? Increasing sympathetic tone. Okay, that's going to have a couple effects. It's going to have increased sympathetic activity is going to increase the heart rate. And there should be a third arrow over here because it's also going to increase stroke volume. The strength of contraction is going to increase. And then the third arrow here says the medulla is going to cause vasoconstriction. So that's going to increase total peripheral resistance. That's going to increase heart rate. It's going to increase stroke volume. And all of these things are going to increase blood pressure, right? According to our little equation right here. And so then your blood pressure goes back to normal. The response subtracts from the stimulus, and that's a nice negative feedback loop. Okay. Is that an exam figure? Maybe? Okay. All right. So if you get lost in that figure, guess what you got to do? This equation right here. And probably you should be able to derive that equation now. Just starting with what cardiac output is and this really simple flow. So cardiac output is a real simple equation, and this flow equation is very, very simple too. All right, but if you don't see that algebra in there, maybe you have to see me after class. Okay, any questions on the heart or the vascular system? Okay. Exercising, I don't really know. It might go up transiently when you're exercising strenuously, okay? But what's going to happen is vasoconstriction in certain blood vessels, like through your digestive tract, okay? So if there's vasoconstriction, that's going to increase blood pressure, okay? But what happens is when you start using muscles, there are chemicals released from the muscle, namely lactic acid, for instance, and pH of muscles will decrease, will become acidic. That's going to cause extreme vasodilation in muscles. So this resistance is going to go way down in muscles. Okay? So in order to maintain blood pressure, that's the reason why your stroke volume and heart rate have to increase. Okay? When you start exercising, because those blood vessels are going to dilate. Because they need those nutrients, they need that oxygen, it needs to wash out the acid, lactic acid, for instance. Okay. So that's maybe what's happening. So I would hope that during exercise your blood pressure doesn't change all that much. Now there is a kind of exercise that people do train themselves to go in, do train themselves for hypertension. Their blood pressure does skyrocket, unfortunately. And that kind of exercise is weightlifting. Okay, so weightlifters, unless they do it properly, will train themselves for hypertension, because a lot of times if you're not trained, when you lift something heavy, you have a tendency to hold your breath, okay, and then you pressurize your chest, that decreases venous return to your heart, your blood pressure starts to drop, and then the baroreceptor takes over and vasoconstricts a bunch of blood vessels all over your body. So weightlifters sometimes have hypertension because they hold their breath when they lift something heavy. Oh, their body learns how to maintain it over long periods of time, and they can actually get sustained hypertension. So the proper way of lifting weights is to never hold your breath when you lift something heavy, and then that will prevent you from developing hypertension. So when you're lifting something heavy, always exhale. That helps you from pressurizing your chest. Okay, so if exercise is done properly, it shouldn't automatically produce hypertension. Okay. All right, so we're done with that chapter. All right, so then we're going to move on to respiratory system. And this is our last chapter. And let's see what kinds of things we can talk about here. Okay, I'm not going to go over a lot of anatomy, with regard to the respiratory system. So you might have to review some things from anatomy, like what are the names of all the passageways that you use for breathing? What makes up the upper airway and the lower airway? What's the structure inside the lung that's specialized for exchange? What's that smallest structure inside the lung that increases the surface area for exchange? Starts with an A. That's called the alveolus. It's that little tiny little berry thing that's an alveolus. Huh? Okay. And, all right, well, let's start talking about some of this stuff. All right, so respiration can have a number of different connotations. All right, respiration, remember we talked about aerobic respiration and anaerobic respiration. Those are biochemical pathways. And when we talk about the lungs, I'm not so much talking about the biochemical pathways as I am, for instance, ventilation and transport of gases in the blood. All right, so when we say respiration in terms of pulmonary function, you should think of ventilation and not metabolic pathways, gas exchange in the lungs, all right, and gas exchange in the tissues, and to a lesser extent, how oxygen is utilized inside the cell. What organelle utilizes oxygen? Do all organelles need oxygen? No, which one particularly needs oxygen? Which one particularly needs oxygen? I think you said, but I didn't quite hear. The mitochondria, right, because of oxidative phosphorylation that's happening inside the mitochondria that's making all that ATP. Okay, so ventilation just moves air in and out of your lungs for gas exchange with the blood. Sometimes we might call that external respiration. All right, gas exchange between the blood and tissues and oxygen used by tissue, sometimes we call that internal respiration. All right, and the way that gases move in your body, like oxygen from the atmosphere to oxygen inside mitochondria, how does oxygen find its way from the atmosphere into a mitochondria to do you some good? What's the driving force? Is there like a little taxi molecule that picks it up and forces it in there? Or how? What's the driving force? The driving force is diffusion. Okay, so how do things move by diffusion? What's the driving force for diffusion? You all are experts in this. Okay, so diffusion, how does something move by diffusion? By the concentration gradient. And which way does a concentration gradient have to go? Or when something moves, how does it move with respect to the concentration gradient? Down the concentration gradient. So always from high to low, right? That's the only way things can move by diffusion. So if oxygen finds its way into mitochondria, or if oxygen is moving from the air into mitochondria, where is there the highest concentration of oxygen? Okay, remember oxygen can go only from down the concentration gradient from high to low. So where is there high oxygen concentration? In the air or in mitochondria? In the air. That's right. And that drives oxygen into mitochondria, right? If oxygen was high in mitochondria, it would actually diffuse out. So it's low in mitochondria, and it's just fortunate that by the time oxygen gets there, there's enough oxygen for the mitochondria to do its job. Okay, so respiratory gases move by diffusion. On the other hand, carbon dioxide, waste product. Whoa, what part of cellular respiration produces CO2? What part of cellular respiration? Krebs cycle. That's right, Krebs cycle. And the preparatory reaction for the Krebs cycle produces CO2, and that CO2 leaves your body by diffusion. All right, it goes into the air, so where is the high concentration of CO2? In mitochondria or in the air? In mitochondria, and then it finds its way out of your body into the air because that's where the lowest concentration is. And the concentration of CO2 in the air is almost zero. So carbon dioxide just loves to leave your body because that concentration gradient is huge. Okay. So that's why we say gas exchange is passive. It's just by diffusion, just operated by the concentration gradient. Okay. So respiratory structures. Well, we're not going to talk much about this because this is just a review from anatomy. right? But you have your trachea that bifurcates into a primary bronchus, and then it bifurcates into secondary and tertiary bronchi going to different lobes or lobules of the lungs. And you probably should know a little bit about the epithelium inside that trachea. What kind of epithelium is that in there? Just as a quick review. It's a pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium, so it's ciliated, so it has these cilia. What's the function of cilia again? They beat, right? So motility is the reason why they're there. They're sweeping, and also in that epithelium there are goblet cells that secrete mucus, so dust gets trapped in the mucus and then the cilia sweep it. Which way do the cilia sweep all that mucus with dust in it? Up or down? Okay, it's going to sweep it up because that's the whole purpose they're there. We don't want the lungs to plug up with stuff. And when that mucus ends up in your pharynx, what do you do? No, you just swallow it down, okay? Unless you're a baseball player, and then what do? And you spit it out, right, okay. Okay, so the functional area for exchange are these alveoli right here. So you have about 8 million alveoli, alveolar sacs, and you have about 300 million alveoli in all of your lungs, okay? And when you think of, we can take an alveolus and flatten it out, kind of peel it like a grape and take the skin of the alveolus and put it flat on a piece of paper and do that for all 300 million, what would be the size of that piece of paper? Okay, it would be a lot, right? Okay, it would be huge. It would be a huge surface area. And when I say surface area, you know maybe what the everyday common functional way to think about surface area is. I don't think I've talked about it in this class. Maybe did I? Not sure. Surface area. What's a term in everyday English language that we could use to describe the function of a surface area? Did I ever describe that to you? Maybe not. I did. I think I did. Okay. I think I found a ruler someplace. And what did I measure? I told you how to calculate a surface area of something. That doorway, okay, which was what? About 2 square meters, right? This personal doorway right here. Did I do that for you guys or no? Yeah? Okay. And how many people can get through a regular doorway at one time? Maybe 2 or 3, something like that. But let's make this doorway bigger, like a garage door. How many people can go through a garage door at one time? Oh, 20, 30, right? So how is surface area related to exchange of people through a doorway? As the surface area increases, what happens to exchange? It increases, so is it directly or inversely related? It's directly related, right? So the bigger the surface area, the faster the exchange. So the surface area of your lungs, okay, if we were to flatten out all of these alveoli right here, would be 70 square meters. So this doorway right here is only 2 square meters, so what is 70 square meters? That's half of a tennis court. So it would be as wide as if your lungs were flat, only had one membrane that was flat, okay, instead of alveoli, it'd have to be 70 square meters, which is half of a tennis court. So that would be huge if that's how your lung worked. So through evolution, it's figured out how to take that big, huge surface area, fold it up, and stick it into a small space. Right? So that's something that's very nice because I can't imagine why I would like to be a tennis court wide and half a tennis court tall. Okay, that'd be really hard. Be really expensive to buy clothes too. Okay. So that's the surface area for exchange. And that happens in the alveolus. And if we look inside an alveolus, it just has a simple squamous epithelium that's very thin. Simple squamous epithelium is designed for diffusion or for exchange. So here we have air inside the alveolus. And this is what we call a type 1 cell, right, that makes up the wall of the alveolus. We have some macrophages that are crawling around inside that alveolus looking for bacteria and dust particles. And a macrophage will phagocytize things that don't belong in your lungs and get rid of them for you, fight infections and things like that. And then the third kind of cell is this type 2 alveolar cell. And the type 2 alveolar cell has a very important and interesting function. Oh, look, here it says right here, about 70 square meters. Good, I wasn't too far off. All right, so let's talk about that type 2 cell. Okay, what can you tell me about water? Is water slippery or is it sticky?
Water.
Yeah, water. I heard sticky. Anybody want to say slippery? No? Okay. Well, you're right. Water is very sticky. Maybe I don't need to do this experiment for you, but okay, it has nothing to do with these balloons sticking to something. But here I have two transparencies. Can you guys, sitting almost in the first row, see I got two of these right here? Okay. And if I put them together, right, and just hold on to one of them, what's going to happen to the other one? It's just going to slide right off, right? But let's glue them together. How could we glue them together? Put some water in between them. Okay, so did anybody turn the water off? No? Good. Okay, so that's all I did. Water. You all saw me just do water. Put them together like that. Okay, and now I'll just hold on to one of them, and what's going to happen to the second one? That's going to stick. Okay, now is it like really stuck or not really stuck? I'll have to help. Somebody will have to help me do the experiment. So I'm going to hold on to this one, and I want you to pull on that one. So, how sticky is that?
Really sticky.
Really, really sticky. All right, so what do we call that? Property of water, the stickiness of water. That's called surface tension, right? Because water are polar molecules. They like to stick together because of what kind of bonds? What kind of bonds make water molecules want to stick together? Hydrogen bonds, okay? So, the inside of your lungs, all of those microscopic alveoli have water inside of them, and if the walls of the alveoli were to touch each other, guess what would happen to them? They would get stuck, okay, just because of water, just because of the surface tension properties of water. So what your lungs do when you have mature lungs, the type 2 cells secrete a chemical compound called surfactant, which stands for surface active agent, and it defeats the surface tension produced by water molecules and makes it that water solution slippery so that the alveoli can expand. So that's the function of this type 2 cell right here. It produces surfactant so the alveolus can expand and fill with air. Without surfactant, your lungs would never be able to inflate. It'd be just stuck together because of surface tension. Okay. Okay, I'm not going to talk about any of this kind of stuff. There are problems. There are problems that can happen for people that don't produce surfactant. All right, here we go. Now I'll go back. Okay. All right, so water molecules are polar. They stick together. And right here, if there are babies that are born prematurely, those type 2 cells don't produce surfactant. And so their lungs don't inflate. We call that respiratory distress syndrome, or RDS. And so what do we have to do with a newborn baby whose lungs aren't inflating because they're not producing surfactant? What do we do for them? Put them in an incubator with high concentrations of oxygen. So even though their lungs aren't functioning properly, right, we increase the oxygen concentration gradient. So that helps oxygen, what? Diffuse into their body and into mitochondria. All right, and that even happens in adults sometimes. We call that acute respiratory distress syndrome, maybe due to septic shock that decreases surfactant secretion, and even adults might not be able to inflate their lungs if the type 2 cells don't secrete surfactant. So that's something very important to be aware of, the type 2 cells. Okay. The other thing that you should be aware of is around each one of these alveoli, which we don't see on this slide, of course there is a network of capillaries for exchange, but there is another network. And you might even want to draw this in on one alveolus. There's a network of elastic fibers. Okay? And what is the cool thing about elastic fibers? When you stretch them, yeah, they can stretch without being damaged, right? So if you put tension on them, they stretch. But the cool thing is when you release that tension, what happens to them? Do they stay the same length? No, they go back to their original length, right? So the elastic properties of the lungs just allow for expiration of gases that you inhale. So under normal quiet breathing, the way that you exhale is just by relaxing. All right, so I'm going to talk about the mechanics of breathing. So after an alveolus inflates, we need a muscle to inflate our lungs, that's the diaphragm. And when we exhale, like you're doing right now for normal, just quiet breathing, all you have to do is relax the diaphragm, and the elastic tissues of the alveolus will cause the alveolus to contract, and that's going to cause exhalation of air that we breathe. So I got a couple models right here, right, that are going to model an alveolus. I got this paper bag, and I've got this balloon, and you got to tell me which one is a better model of an alveolus. All right, so what do we do to an alveolus first? We inflate it, right? When we inhale, it inflates. So I'm going to inflate this paper bag. Okay, and then I close it off nice and tight like that so air can't escape. All right, and I said exhalation for quiet breathing is just passive. All right, so here's an alveolus. And if I release this bag, what's going to happen to all that air inside the bag? Is it going to come out? Or is it just going to stay there? Okay, so there I go. Right, I'll even open it up a little bit. What happens? Oh, the air is stuck inside this bag right here. Can't be released. Well, if your lungs were like that, what would inspiration be like next time? Could you inhale? No, if there's air in there to begin with, you can't inhale anymore, so that's not going to do you any good. All right. So here is a balloon. But don't forget, this is a model of an alveolus. All right, so we used our diaphragm to inflate this alveolus, and if I let go of the alveolus right here, okay, what's going to happen? Is it going to deflate? Okay, is air going to leave the lungs, and why? Oof. Okay, so that alveolus did what? It collapsed. You exhaled, and why is that? Because there are elastic fibers in that balloon, right? The latex in that balloon is elastic, and so when you release that tension, it's automatically going to deflate. So in a normal, healthy individual, your lungs just normally deflate by themselves passively. You don't need muscles for quiet breathing, like what you're doing right now. That's not necessarily true when you start exercising, though. That's a different kind of breathing. All right, so don't forget about those elastic fibers right here. And some people lose those elastic fibers. And guess what they have trouble doing? They have trouble breathing because they can't exhale. They can't get air out of their lungs. Okay. I think you're going to just have to review some of the anatomy right here for yourself. Okay, the pleural membrane is a serous membrane. How many parts does a serous membrane have? As opposed to a mucous membrane. It's got three parts to it. Whoa. All right, maybe you're not aware of this, but there is the... So here are the lungs. Right on the surface of the lungs is the visceral pleura. Okay, right on the surface of an organ, visceral organ is what we call the visceral pleura. And then that's continuous with the membrane that lines the body wall. That would be the parietal pleura. And there is a fluid in between them. We call that the pleural fluid or serous fluid. Okay. And the interesting thing about that serous fluid is that it's a lot different than the fluid that's inside the lungs. Because inside the lungs, what do we secrete into an alveolus to decrease surface tension again? Surfactant. Okay. So that the alveoli don't stick together. But the serous fluid right here actually should be sticky so that when you expand your chest walls, that helps couple the expansion of the chest wall and that pulls on the lungs to expand the lungs when you want to inhale. So this pleural fluid right here should not have any surfactant in it at all. It should just be a nice sticky watery substance which attaches the parietal pleura to the visceral pleura, and that helps expand the lungs. Okay, so the two different fluids in the lungs. Physical aspects of ventilation. Let's talk about that. So ventilation results from pressure differences induced by changes in lung volume. And don't forget, any kind of fluid, whether it's a gas or liquid, is going to move from an area of high pressure to low pressure. Just like concentration gradient drives diffusion, pressure drives the motion, the physical motion of fluids. And here are some terms that affect ventilation: compliance, elasticity, and surface tension. Two of these we talked about already. Elasticity is important for, okay, of course, inspiration, because things have to stretch, but just as important for expiration, because that elasticity does what? It causes air to be expelled from your lungs. Surface tension is important for two reasons. You need to defeat surface tension in the alveolus so it can expand, but you have to maintain surface tension in the pleural space so that the wall of the thoracic cavity attaches itself to the wall of the lungs. All right? And compliance is just a measure of how much the lung can expand when it is pressurized. Okay, so the visceral and parietal pleura normally adhere to each other, so the lungs remain attached or in contact to the chest walls. That's because there's no surfactant in the pleural space. And so the lungs expand and contract when the thoracic cavity expands and contracts. Okay. So during inspiration, intrapulmonary pressure decreases. So intrapulmonary pressure is just a pressure inside the lungs. And I'll show you how that happens in just a second. All right. And during expiration, the intrapulmonary pressure increases. All right. So that means that the pressure inside the lung goes above atmospheric pressure. On inspiration, the pressure is lower than atmospheric pressure by about 3 millimeters of mercury. And that's enough to move air in and out of our lungs. And that's due to Boyle's law. So here's another little equation, not very complicated, that says that the pressure in a space is related to the volume. All right, so let's make this a closed space so that nothing can exchange. All right, so how is pressure related to volume? Is it directly related or inversely related? Directly or inversely related? We should go down the line. Somebody should say. Okay. Well, what about this blood pressure equation? Blood pressure is related to stroke volume, heart rate, and resistance. Which way? Directly or inversely? Directly related. Directly related. So if any of these go up, so does blood pressure. What about Boyle's law? We see it's what? It's inversely related. Right? They use kind of a fancy little thing right there, but it's pressure is equal to 1 over the volume. So if the volume increases, what happens to pressure? It decreases because of that inverse relationship. Or if volume decreases, what happens to pressure? It increases. So let's just think of we can think of that balloon again. All right, so if we have a balloon and we close it off and we decrease the volume in that balloon, what are we going to do to the balloon to decrease the volume? We're going to squeeze it. What happens to the pressure in that balloon when we squeeze it? Well, we're decreasing the volume, so the pressure increases. Okay, so that's a way to think of this inverse relationship, which we call Boyle's law. All right, so the pressure of a gas is proportional to the volume, but it's inversely related. Increasing lung volume decreases the intrapulmonary pressure, right, because it's inversely related. Increasing volume decreases pressure. Decreasing volume increases pressure. And that's how things are moved in and out of your lungs. Okay, and compliance is just a measure of how fast your lung volume changes. Right? That is the change in lung volume per change in this pressure across the lungs. Okay, and different disease processes will affect this compliance. Okay, and elasticity, we talked about already. That's just due to those elastic fibers around the alveoli. These are very important for what? Expiration. It's important for inspiration because without elastic fibers, the alveoli can't stretch, but just as important for expiration because these elastic fibers pull on the alveolus and make them small again. Okay, and we talked about surface tension. Okay. Right here. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the mechanics of breathing. All right, so pulmonary ventilation consists of two phases, right? Inspiration, which is inhalation, and expiration, which is exhalation. And that's accomplished by alternately increasing and decreasing volumes of the thorax and thus the lungs. So here we got a couple x-rays. I don't know if I want to show you, but right here would be about where, no, right about here is where your diaphragm is. Okay, let's see what else we got. Okay, so there are two kinds of breathing that we can undergo. Quiet breathing is what you're doing right now. This is what you do when you're not exercising. And the other kind of breathing is what we call forced breathing. That's when you start to exercise and start to hyperventilate. So let's consider quiet breathing first. All right, inspiration occurs mainly due to the contraction of one muscle, and that's the diaphragm. And when the diaphragm contracts, that increases the thoracic volume in a vertical direction. So here is the diaphragm. When the diaphragm is relaxed, it forms a dome-shaped structure, and when it contracts, that dome gets pulled all the way down inferiorly, so it increases the vertical dimension of the thoracic cavity. So that increases the volume of the thoracic cavity. What happens to the pressure inside the lungs when the volume of the lungs increase? Okay, so as the diaphragm contracts, this volume gets bigger. What happens to pressure inside the lungs? It decreases because it's inversely related. And when pressure inside the lungs is less than atmospheric pressure, so now you have high pressure in the air, low pressure in your lungs, which way is air going to flow? It's going to go from high to low inside your lungs as a result of that. Okay, so here we have a little model that might actually show that. Here is a model of the thoracic cavity, and there is your little trachea right there. Okay, and the balloons represent your lungs, and you can see the primary bronchi right there. And in this model, of course, the thoracic cavity can't change shape, but the diaphragm can move, right? So this flat rubber piece right here represents your diaphragm. So when it's relaxed, it's what? Dome-shaped. And when the diaphragm contracts, it's going to flatten out, increasing the volume inside the thoracic cavity. So what's going to happen to these little lungs right here? Can anybody see? What state are they in now when the diaphragm is relaxed? Are they deflated or inflated? They're deflated, right? And when the diaphragm contracts, let me know if you can see what happens. I can't plug the trachea, so I'll hold it here. Look what happens to the lungs. They inflate, okay? And then when you relax the diaphragm has elastic tissue in it as well. It goes back to its normal position, and the elastic properties of the alveolus cause the air to leave. So under quiet breathing, this is what you're doing all the time. So are there any muscles in these balloons right here causing them to inflate and deflate? Absolutely not. This is just due to Boyle's law, right, and expansion of the thoracic cavity causing pressure changes, which allows for ventilation to happen or air to flow in and out of the lungs. Okay, so that's pretty much it for quiet breathing. Okay, for deep breathing, all right, for deep breathing, we can use some other muscles to help out. All right, so when you're hyperventilating, there are intercostal muscles between these ribs right here, and the muscles that are used for inspiration are the external intercostals. Okay, because the external intercostals will pull the ribs up anteriorly, will pull the ribs out and up laterally. That also increases the volume of the thoracic cavity, just like depression of the diaphragm. That increases the volume of the thoracic cavity, and you will inhale. Okay, but for quiet expiration, how would you explain quiet expiration when you're not hyperventilating? It's just completely passive, as we say on this slide right here. Due to what? Elastic properties of the alveoli and elastic properties of the diaphragm and the other muscles of the chest too. Okay, so forced breathing requires some other muscles. Inspiration involves the contraction of extra muscles like the scalenes and pectoralis major and even the sternocleidomastoid. So here we see the scalenes and the sternocleidomastoid, and pectoralis minor is right in there as well. All right, when these muscles contract, you can see it puts traction on these upper ribs. It lifts the ribs up. That increases the volume of the thoracic cavity. And also, the external intercostals will contract. And it's going to raise these ribs up as well. So that's for forced breathing. So the diaphragm, the scalenes, pectoralis minor, and sternocleidomastoid are important for forced breathing or deep breathing. But when you're hyperventilating, you need to move air out of your lungs a lot faster compared to what might happen under just a passive process. So there are some muscles that will help you expire air or will decrease the volume of the thoracic cavity. And those would be the internal intercostals. They're going to pull the ribs down and medially, right? So they're going to have the opposite action compared to the external intercostals. And another way to decrease the thoracic volume right here is to take abdominal contents, things that are in the abdominal cavity, and force them up into the thoracic cavity. So there are muscles that can do that. What kind of muscles can take abdominal organs and force them up into the thoracic cavity, decreasing the volume of the thoracic cavity? What muscles do you have making up your abdominal wall? You've got the rectus abdominis, and you got the internal oblique, external oblique, right? So all of those muscles of the abdominal compartment can be used for forceful expiration. Okay. All right, so here you see the diaphragm relaxed. When it contracts, it flattens out. That's going to decrease the intrapulmonary pressure because the volume gets large, air will flow in. And during expiration, the diaphragm goes back because of its elastic properties, and the elastic properties of the alveolus will cause expiration. That's just under passive breathing. Okay, and it's very important to be able to measure the different volumes that somebody can breathe. And it's going to change over your lifetime and under different kinds of disease processes. And there's an instrument that you probably even used in lab that can measure the volume of air that you can breathe in at a particular time. That's called a spirometer. So a spirometer can measure lung volumes and capacities. So that study of lung volumes is what we call spirometry because it's named after that instrument that we use to measure lung volumes. Okay. So here is... this, I'm sure, is an exam figure, too. At least I hope it is. Okay, it should be. Okay, that is a diagram of lung volume versus, this is kind of like a time axis right here, that shows the different volumes that somebody has in their lungs, at least a normal individual. So the total lung volume we can see is almost 6 liters in a normal individual. It's about 5,700 liters. And we breathe in and out constantly, right? And can you see a volume here that repeats itself over and over and over and over and over and over again? That is this thing right here. Okay, so we call that tidal volume. So when you're breathing quietly, like you're doing right now, you're just slowly bringing air in your lungs and letting it exhale. That's what we call tidal volume. And that's almost 500 mLs. Okay, and notice, where does that take place? Does that take place at the very bottom of your total lung capacity or up at the top? It actually exists kind of like right here in the middle. All right. So this means that after the end of a normal inspiration, you can actually force a lot more air into your lungs if you try really hard, okay, using more muscles like the external intercostals, okay, to raise the rib cage up. All right. So at the end of a normal inspiration right here, what can you do? You can take even more air into your lungs, maximally, to get more oxygen into your body. We call that the inspiratory reserve volume. So from the top of a normal tidal volume to a maximal inspiration is what we call inspiratory reserve volume. So during exercise, you can get a lot more oxygen into your tissues. Also, at the end of a normal expiration, a normal tidal volume, what can you do? You can even force more air out of your lungs, like, and you can maximally force as much air out of your lungs, get to a maximal expiration right here. So this volume is what we call expiratory reserve volume. All right, so these are the major volumes that you have control over with your conscious thought. And there is volume inside the lungs that you can never get out. And that's what we call the residual volume. All right, so remember, the alveoli don't collapse completely. And the bronchioles don't collapse completely. The bronchi don't collapse completely. So they always contain some amount of air. And that's what we call the residual volume inside the lungs. So unless you take somebody's lungs and completely flatten them out, they're always going to have some residual air left in them. So that's what we call residual volume. So the amount of air that you consciously can control is the sum of the expiratory reserve, the tidal volume, and the inspiratory reserve volume. And that's just the capacity that you have to exchange oxygen with the rest of your body. So we call that the vital capacity. So vital capacity is the sum of those three volumes. And that does not include the residual volume. Okay, this functional residual capacity, I'm not so concerned about that you know that, but the total lung capacity you should probably know. All right, so when somebody has lung disease, a lot of times their tidal volume might stay the same, but they lose pulmonary function because their residual volume increases as they live their life from day to day, month to month. And as their residual volume increases, what happens to their vital capacity? The vital capacity decreases because their lungs don't get any bigger. Okay? So as residual volume gets bigger and bigger and bigger, right, that squeezes down the vital capacity. And then sooner or later, this residual volume is so big that the only thing they have left is tidal volume. They have no reserve capacity whatsoever, no inspiratory reserve or expiratory reserve. And when they lose so much pulmonary function, okay, when the residual volume takes up almost all of their lung, then what happens? When they can't breathe in and out because there's no tidal volume left, it's all just residual volume, then, of course, you need a lung transplant when that happens, okay? Okay, or you just die. Okay, so make sure you know how to label all these different lung volumes or pulmonary volumes. Okay. All right, factors affecting gas exchange. I don't know what I want to talk to you about in terms here. Okay. I might go back to that on Monday. Here you see an alveolus, okay, and the capillary network around it, but there's another network around this alveolus right here, which is the elastic tissue network. Don't forget about that. Okay. Okay. Well, you know what? I think I'm going to stop here for today. Oh, you know what? I do want to talk about this. Okay, how is oxygen transported by the blood? Okay, in red blood cells, I think we've talked about this already. It's carried in red blood cells. It is carried by a chemical that's in red blood cells. What's the name of that chemical? It's called hemoglobin, right? So oxygen binds to hemoglobin. And hemoglobin carries oxygen through the blood. Okay, but carbon dioxide, a byproduct of your respiration, does not bind to hemoglobin, or very, very weakly. And carbon dioxide has to be transported by your blood. So the way that it's transported is that it's converted into something that dissolves in blood very easily. So if we, here's carbon dioxide, the byproduct of cellular respiration. It can combine with water to form a substance, H2CO3. That's carbonic acid. All right, and carbonic acid dissolves in water 100%, like in plasma. And then carbonic acid then dissociates to this hydrogen ion and bicarbonate. So carbon dioxide is transported by the blood as bicarbonate ion right here. But this is a chemical reaction, and this might not happen fast enough in your body to transport carbon dioxide. So what do we do, or what is one way to increase the rate of a chemical reaction? Your body uses this all the time. Okay, it makes an enzyme. So an enzyme speeds up the rate of this chemical reaction. And as a matter of fact, you see that this chemical reaction has this bidirectional arrow right here. That means that it can go forwards and it can go backwards depending on, or depends on, Le Chatelier's principle, or that principle of mass action. What does that say? Let's say we take out all of this bicarbonate right here. Which way is this reaction going to proceed? It's going to proceed to the right to fill this chemical back up, right? Or, for instance, if we produce a lot of CO2 by exercising, which way is this reaction going to go? It, again, is going to go to the right to decrease this excess carbon dioxide. All right, and then as we lose CO2, then bicarbonate is going to be used to replenish that CO2 that's lost, for instance, when you exhale. All right, and the name of this enzyme, you got to know, that's what we call carbonic anhydrase. Right, so here is carbonic anhydrase. That's the name of the enzyme that interconverts CO2, which is only relatively soluble in plasma, into bicarbonate, which is very soluble in plasma. So in the tissues and the lungs, which one has a higher carbon dioxide concentration, in your tissues or your lungs? Tissues or lungs? Because we want to move carbon dioxide, what, out of our body. How is carbon dioxide going to move by diffusion? From high to low. So the tissues have high carbon dioxide. So in the tissues where there's high carbon dioxide, because of Le Chatelier's principle, the tissues are going to produce a lot of bicarbonate ion, which is transported by the blood. Okay. Now that blood that has high bicarbonate or high CO2 goes into the lungs. And now what about the air? Air has low CO2. The blood has high CO2. Which way is CO2 going to move? It's going to move from the blood into the air. And when the blood loses CO2, can you see by Le Chatelier's principle and carbonic anhydrase, bicarbonate is going to come out of the blood and form CO2, which is going to do what? Diffuse from blood into the alveolus, and then you exhale it. Okay, so that's the beauty of this carbonic anhydrase reaction. So it produces bicarbonate in your tissues and in the lungs. Carbonic anhydrase produces CO2 so that you can exhale it from your body. Okay, the other thing that I want to point out is when you produce CO2 and it's converted into carbonic acid and then eventually bicarbonate, what else is produced? Hydrogen ions, right? So as your body produces CO2, it is also decreasing the pH. Okay, so that's going to produce an acidosis. Okay, and for instance, we can lose a lot of CO2 in our bodies by hyperventilating. Okay, if we start to breathe heavily just by voluntary control of your muscles, we could all start hyperventilating. Our bodies are going to lose a lot of CO2. How is this reaction going to react? If we lose a lot of CO2 from the blood, what's going to happen? Because of Le Chatelier's principle. Bicarbonate is going to be converted into carbonic acid, which then converts to CO2, and you're going to excrete that from your body. But when you lose bicarbonate from your body this way, what happens to hydrogen ion? It gets consumed as well. So that when somebody hyperventilates, that produces an alkalosis, because we are actually excreting a lot of acid or hydrogen ions from our body just by hyperventilating. So hyperventilation can produce what we call a respiratory alkalosis. just by hyperventilating. So our breath, you could consider that as being very acidic, okay, because of the CO2 that we're breathing out. And that acid comes from, what, this bicarbonate system right here. So hyperventilation causes low CO2, or hypocapnia. Hypoventilation causes high CO2, or hypercapnia, which also affects your pH balance as well. Okay. All right, well, that's it for today. No lecture on Wednesday. So on Wednesday, we have no lecture and we have no test. Okay, because that's the beginning of finals week. And some of you might actually have a final scheduled for Wednesday during the same time that we're scheduled for lecture. So because it's finals week, we can't have a lecture.